नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स अपरुथादे संगम तस्स तवरा ए सोदवन्ता बमुञ्चन्तु सतं So on this day, Easter Sunday, I have this opportunity to reflect on Dhamma, the way it is. And reflecting isn't thinking, it's witnessing. When we say contemplate the truth or reflect on the way it is, then we immediately start thinking and trying to describe how you might, how you feel or experience this moment. But when I use the word reflection, it's, or the word contemplation, it's not thinking, it's being a witness, pure witnessing of all conditions are impermanent, all Dhamma is not personal. So all Dhamma is not a person. Dhamma is ultimate reality. And so we try to imagine ultimate reality. You can't do it. You can imagine all kinds of things, sense, nonsense, right and wrong, good and bad, virtue and vice, but ultimate reality, one's mind goes blank, it's just empty. So is ultimate reality is the Dhamma, as we say? Is it just emptiness, which in terms of the intellect seems rather unpleasant, because our minds are filled with a sense of self. Personal self is very strong because we've been conditioned to do that. So learning to see the ego as a condition rather than as a person. Who really cares about life, good and bad, right and wrong? And you can see that it's personal, very personal about what's right, what's wrong, what's true, what's false. But in you really penetrate that, who really cares? You realize that the Dhamma, the pure consciousness, doesn't care. It doesn't produce caring feelings or anything. It's pure, unblemished, perfect. So I found a very useful practice to say to myself, who cares when things, crises arise in the Sangha or in the nation or whatever, whether it's, natural disasters or upheavals or revolutions. I can see my personality cares, can feel more, can take sides. But I'm aware of that. So this reflection on the way it is that my personality still functions, but I know what it is. It's an empty phenomena where when we see ourselves through the delusion of a separate self, then we feel victims of fate or misfortune, or we get caught up in taking sides in jealousies and conflicts, personal preferences, strong views. And then there's conflict, and that's the nature of samsara, is it's a realm of conflicts, whether personal, family, political, religious. We can make causes out of almost everything. What's right, what's wrong, and not that, but the practice of mindfulness, of awareness, is to see that right and wrong are relative to conditions. There's nothing absolutely right or nothing absolutely wrong. When the conditions for right arise, then right is like this, but it is not stable. It's not going to last when you are the witness rather than the victim of karma. I found the escape from suffering is in taking refuge in awareness, conscious awareness in Dhamma. It's not just an imagined refuge of an imagined Dhamma. It's not some kind of abstract idea I have developed about what Dhamma is. It's the realization of Dhamma is apparent here and now, as I've said many, many times. So it's not something that you find, it's something that you are. So that means the reference to the world that we experience through the body and the senses is the way it is. You know, we've been conditioned in so many ways to, in what's right and wrong and what's true and false, what's good and bad. Because that's the world, that's samsara. It's all about right and wrong, good and bad, virtue and vice. God and the devil. So understanding the personality is the first fetter, and it is the major fetter that blinds us to the way it is. As long as you operate trying to get enlightened or get something out of meditation as a person, sometimes it's going to go well. Your people will say, I had a really good meditation. And then next day they'll say, oh, my meditation was bad. And so because they're expecting peace and harmony and what they desire, a good meditation, and they interpret it in those terms of good and bad meditation. And Lungpa Cha once told me, said, good meditation is good, bad meditation is good. So that was. And if you understand what reflection is, then you realize what that really means. Don't expect your meditation to be always peaceful and quiet and you're in a temple or on a retreat. Because then you're still operating from the separate self. The separate self is a basic delusion. You know, ask yourself, who am I? Who am I really? Am I the body, this body? Who am I, this personality? You know, and then when you investigate the personality, the ego, you're witnessing it rather than grasping it. And that's why I give so many encouragements and instructions to be the witness to thought, rather than trying to imagine or have definitions for everything. Like, what is good meditation? What is bad meditation? So good meditation is, we in quotes, means that, you know, the conditions are quiet and peaceful, and the world is not, you're not in conflict at the moment. You feel at peace. You might feel unconditioned love for all sentient beings. You might feel really happy. These are all desirable conditions. But then when something happens, distressing noises or news or whatever, then that's interfering with my good meditation. We can feel angry and upset at somebody who sneezes or makes a loud noise, slams a door. But if you're the being, if you take refuge in Bhutto, the witnessing position of Dhamma, it's only through that. Bhutto is not a person. It's not taking refuge in a person. Buddha is awareness here and now. It means awakenness rather than always referring to the sage Gautama the Buddha. People always are asking questions about sound of silence or emptiness. Because, you know, I use those words. And when you just the word sound of silence, the words themselves are sankharas. So if you're wanting to notice the sound of silence as a person, you know, you miss it every time because the personality is not silent. Personality is words, concepts, views and opinions. And I review my life as I get old about all the memories of the past and how my sense of a separate self was formed from, you know, when I was a child. And, you know, you awaken to the fact you're not really what you've been told or been conditioned to believe. Where so much of my suffering was because I had all these strong views about sin and virtue and values of my culture, about good and bad, right and wrong. This is a Christian holiday today, Easter. And I was conditioned to actually believe this is when Jesus arose from the grave. And as a child, I could believe that, because what references did I have except my mother's absolute faith and belief in the actual terminology. So every morning, on Easter morning, my mother would greet me saying, "He has risen." And then I am supposed to say, reply, "He has risen indeed." And then one's supposed to feel very happy that this happened on Easter. And Easter is a celebration. Easter eggs, chocolate bunnies. And it's a joyous day because our Savior has physically risen from being dead into risen into heaven. Well, I'm not criticizing that, but that's part of a conditioning you receive and genuinely felt by my mother and father, by Christian religion that I grew up in. But witnessing isn't Christian or even Buddhist. It's not, it has no name. Buddha is not a Buddhist. Buddha is awakened awareness here and now. And when that memory of "He has risen" on Easter comes, I can see it as just words that I was programmed with in my innocent years as a child. My mother was a very virtuous person, so, you know, I had no reason to disbelieve or question her. So then, in teenage, when I became a teenager, that's the years where your kind of rebellious instincts start operating, starting to question. And then when I started questioning, then I was told that you shouldn't question. It's a doubt. You shouldn't doubt. Doubt is a sin. Well, in Buddhism, Buddhism, doubt is a fetter, because it's all about grasping thoughts, views, opinions. So when people ask me about death and the deathless and sound of silence and emptiness, these words are just, you know, the best you can do with conditioned phenomena to try to point to the unconditioned reality of consciousness. So they're all words. Absolute reality are two words. Buddha is a word. Dhamma is a word. Sangha is a word. They have a beginning and an end. They're good words. Virtuous words or vulgar words, but all words, whether they're virtuous or vulgar, are impermanent phenomena when you are the witness, the puto, of the way it is. You know, I used to practice just trying to hold a word and observe how it affects my mind. So, you know, then I, a teenager, I kind of rebelled against Christianity. Because then I took an opinion, it's not true. It's not a human body from a grave rising up into heaven. It didn't make any sense. Because heaven, you know, is supposed to be where everything is beautiful and wonderful, and who wants to rise from the grave at 90 years old and live forever in heaven? You know, when you ask yourself these kind of questions, it doesn't sound very attractive. But then they explain it that you get a celestial body or ethereal body, but it's very personal. Everything is personal. Your soul is personal. We have separate souls. And we believe that. So because we never investigate. Can you really find a separate soul through investigation? Or what is a soul? When they talk about my soul, and we tend to think of it as something very personal. What happens to the soul when the body dies? And so these are questions that people ask, because you can't help but wonder, is it when the body dies, is it just oblivion? There's no soul, no nothing, you're just dead, and nothing, just memories that you leave behind. But when you investigate sakyaditti, the first fetter, or the ego, sense of a separate self, you begin to see it's something to no longer cling to, no longer have to feel separate. So separation is a division of male and female. It's a division between black and white, Jew and Gentile. It's a division between we divide the world into our friends, our enemies, the nations we approve of and the nations we don't like. That's news. And we do have preferences as people. So like the problem with DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. You know, that, and my personality, that appeals to me. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. But then in the United States now, somebody is DEI there. They're considered dangerous. Because people have taken sides. Now, the diversity, equity, and inclusion are really rather kind of ideals that people think in their mind. Because on the level of experience, we're all diverse. The forms are diverse. And we have prejudice against some forms and some people and some religions, races, genders. And this idea of diversity is to be tolerant, which to me is very kind of a skillful state of being tolerant of diversity, rather than being intolerant of the diversity of human beings, genders, races, religions. Because I've been very much a kind of idealistic person. Equity, equality. Well, in equality, we can't be equal in forms. You know, because some young and old people, are they equal, male and female, or Africans and Europeans, and equal in terms of form and experience, but equality in terms of accepting the differences and not identifying as a superior or better, I'm better than you, or I'm not as good as you are. And inclusion as a more kind of being able to include people rather than form exclusive cults that exclude. That's how I interpret that. And yet there are many people that see it as a threat to their position in the world, because they hold firmly to views about superiority or inferiority, right and wrong. We have memories, and we remember, you know, I have many memories. Going back to the 1930s. And so there's a whole lot of things that have changed a lot, where I think my youth was in the 50s, when I was a young, older teenager. I was 19 when I enlisted in the Navy in 1953. And there was just so many things taken for granted that you never questioned. The questions that DEI bring up in the mind were not questions that one thought or had it during my experience in the 1950s. There's just a lot that seems normal and right according to the way you experience it. You saw many inequalities that, especially racial equalities and inequalities, that you felt were wrong. I felt that I never was a racist. But they weren't big issues back in 1950. They weren't in the accepted consciousness of most people. This is the way it is, and it's always been this way, and just the assumption being a white Christian male was, you know, that was never a problem, never feeling inferior as a race, because it was assumed the white race was superior. And one didn't question that assumption. And then the questioning takes place during my youth, during my middle age, and so forth, and, you know, moving more towards equality, inclusion, diversity. And now those very words are very dangerous in the United States, because there's a movement to create seeing that as very threatening to one's position that one is clinging to in society. So when I think, who cares? That sounds rather callous, because, you know, in my liberal, woke personality, it tends to be, you should care about these problems, political, racial, international problems, because they are something to care about. But in terms of meditation and Dhamma, they are all just changing conditions. The ego, the viewpoint, the DEI, all these are concepts that have arisen due to other conditions. And in that, in realizing just the ephemeral quality, nature of phenomena, you no longer want to hold on to phenomena. You realize it's like that's where the suffering of life is. It's taking sides and caring and hating the opposite and worried about the inequalities or worried about losing your superior position in the society or in the world. All these are phenomena that arise and cease according to other conditions. And when you let go of all that, complete letting go of opinions and views, then there's silence. Conscious awareness is silent. It's not a sound. Sound of silence, those words are a bit misleading. But when you let go, you do experience peace. And peace is silent. It's not about right and wrong, good or bad, male and female anymore. And that's what we all really long for. We want peace. And when we're looking for peace as something to find, you know, we're going to see conflicts and unpeaceful things that are unfair, unequal, that separate and divide and discriminate, because that's what the personality does. You can't help but feel separate from everyone around. What is loneliness? What is it? How does loneliness arise? Because people, feel very lonely, even though they have family and they have friends. But loneliness is the ego, because, you know, it's hard to find somebody who agrees with you, who can be your true friend, loyal and loving your whole life, because things change. You know, when we're trying to find a partner, a friend, that's going to be my best friend for life, then that's the cause of loneliness, because even best friends don't agree on everything. Husband and wives don't agree on every issue. Brothers and sisters don't agree on everything. Because that's the nature of samsara and the ego. So in feeling loneliness is refuge in Dhamma, is that lonely? Well, there's no one to be lonely in Dhamma. the separateness is gone. There's silence, which is peace, bliss, so who really cares? And I found that a relief, just to not be caught up in my ideals, no matter how noble they might be, or caught up in issues about who's right and who's wrong, and all the issues that even sanghas produce. Because then one, if it takes sides, one can't help but have preferences, what's right and what's wrong. Just around Vinaya alone, monks can quarrel endlessly about what's right or wrong with the Vinaya rules. So I remember in reading Life of the Buddha, the Kosambi bhikkhus were having some kind of argument about water in the bathroom, or some kind of trivial issue, and they were fighting with each other, and Buddha became so fed up with the whole thing, he went off, lived in the jungle, and was supported by a monkey and an elephant. And oftentimes I felt that, like, I just fed up with all these trivial opinions and views around rules and precepts. Because it's you know, they're strict and loose and ways of looking at Vinaya, that which is right and which is wrong. And being a bhikkhu for so many years, you know, you've been through the years of being very tight and rigid about the rules, and then realizing the suffering of just being caught up in when I see things as not as my view of being right, or somebody else's view of being right. As a person, I can easily get caught up in those kind of situations. But then I ask myself, who cares really? Does pure conscious awareness care? And then you begin to see Vinaya as not something rigid and absolute right and wrong, but just guiding principles towards behavior. So it's more a sense of sangha through Vinaya that's managed to survive to this present moment. You know, how many Buddhas have appeared in history, you know, so there's like 28 Buddhas we can chant. And Bajika Buddhas, what are Bajika Buddhas? You know, they're Buddhas that never left any teachings behind to follow, or never established a Vinaya program. So then, Gotama the Buddha established a Dhamma, which has no words. So like, how do you teach Dhamma? You know, that was his first, according to the scriptures, his first question was, how, there's nothing to teach. And then he was encouraged to go forth, and then his teaching was based on the common human experience that we all recognize of suffering. So that's insight, that's helpful. Because why do we suffer? What is the cause of suffering? Why when I come from a good family and have all kinds of advantages and opportunities as an individual, why should I suffer? And then investigating the ego, I say, when I don't get my own way, I suffer as a person. When somebody insults me, I suffer as a person. When people want to have racial biases, gender biases, and all this, then and they don't agree with me, I suffer as a person. But as absolute reality, which is conscious awareness here and now, then who cares? It drops away. And you begin to have a clear view of the way things are as all that arises ceases. Sape sankhara anicca, sape tamanata, all dhamma is not self. The Dhamma is not a person. And as a person, when you try to realize Dhamma, you can't do it. Our personalities, they're limited because they're forms, empty forms that arise and cease. So the grief and despair and doubt that arise amongst the Buddhist community who meditate are caught in views and opinions and about themselves or about their teachers, about the scriptures, about the precepts. And that when we make everything personal like that, what I believe, my view is right view, what does that sound like in a very conceited way when somebody says, I'm a stream enterer? Well, the personality wants to be a stream enterer. You ordained to become an arahant, to realize nibbana. Those are all words we say when we're ordained, ordaining to realize ultimate reality or nibbana. And then in investigation, observing just the ego, my ego, I realize my ego is very limited condition. It can't, even at best, even after all these years as a Buddhist monk, the personality is still very limited and suffers from the conflicts and problems that arise that one experiences in life, in old age. So thinking is empty. Dhamma is perfect. And it's apparent here now. So as a person, none of us are perfect. But our real nature is perfect. So when I tell people their true nature is perfect, they tend to see that very personally. And they think I'm a bit crazy or idealistic, but it's true. When you realize your true nature is apparent here and now, is Dhamma, the silence, the peaceful, blissful silence of here and now, then the personality is just a function that carries you through life, but it's no longer what your refuge. You're no longer idealizing life and how it should or shouldn't be, you realize that the nature of phenomena is to change. And that the Buddha pointed out very clearly in his first sermon, the Four Noble Truths. So ask yourself, am I a good meditator? Is my meditation good or is it bad? And just listen to it. And people say, I can't meditate at Amaravati. I need to go off to a cave and meditate. Or there's too much work or too much busyness. Just listen to it. It's not you shouldn't think like that. But the practice is being a witness to how you're actually feeling. Amaravati's like this. Rather than, I think it should change the way I think, I believe, you know, I've got the right view. And then we get caught up in our egos, which want to be right and make everything right, but then that will never happen. Amaravati is a place for reflection, encouragement to investigate, and is very clearly explained in the Buddha's teachings, and his Four Noble Truths, his basic sermon. As well as all the other suttas that exist, the dependent origination. I found all these teachings very helpful, not as grasping teachings, trying to personally understand them, but to use them for investigating experience. I remember when I first came across Paticca Samuppada, or dependent origination. It just seemed so complicated. And I kept thinking, I can't get my mind around this. My mind wasn't conditioned to think in terms of the concepts that follow in sequence. Ignorance is the cause of suffering. Well, that's very basic, but in the Paticca Samuppada, in dependent origination, as long as there's ignorance, there's going to be suffering. And it traces to the whole realities of sankharas, consciousness, feelings, and that, and grasping that take us to griefs. Sorrow, despair, anguish. And that you can actually witness to in your life here. As long as I operate from my personal operating as a separate person, then there's grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish as a result of that. But if I see that, if I let go of that grasping of avijja, ignorance of Dhamma, if I let go of my grasping tendencies, then what's left when you're not grasping anything is Dhamma, where the whole sequence of Paticca Samuppada collapses. So this is, you know, it's to be a skillful means to investigate experience, not something just to chant in Pali, but to, you know, it's an investigatory teaching that I found extremely helpful in breaking through my own grasping tendencies as a person. So I end this reflection and say, Happy Easter, everyone.